Good evening and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art. I'm Roxana Markoch, curator in the Department of Photography and moderator of tonight's panel discussion, organized in conjunction with the exhibition Comic Abstraction, Image Breaking, Image Making, currently on view until June 11 in the Special Exhibitions Gallery on the third floor. It is my great pleasure and honor to share the panel with three remarkable artists whose works are included in the exhibition, Polly Apfelbaum, Inka Ezenhai, and Gary Simmons. And I take this opportunity to also thank them for their generous collaboration on the show and also on the catalog, to which they have contributed insightful interviews. Tonight's discussion will have the following format. I will introduce the exhibition. The artist will make 15-minute presentations discussing their work, and then we will open the floor to the public for questions. And at this point, I would also like to ask you to turn off your cell phones. Thank you. Comic Abstraction, Image Breaking, Image Making is an exhibition conceived as a visual essay. And when I say this, I mean it is not other things that an exhibition could be. It is not a survey, it is not an attempt at identifying a zeitgeist, and certainly it is not a pretense for canonizing a movement. Rather, this is an exhibition that presents an innovative, conceptually persuasive argument about the creative misalliance between comics and abstraction through the perspective of 13 international artists whose works of the last two decades bridge the rift between two models of representation. While many exhibitions in the past have explored the impact of comics on art, they all focused on figuration and easily identifiable pop characters and themes. This show approaches the topic from a different angle. It looks at how artists have abstracted images culled from slapstick, comic strips and films, cartoons and animation to address in a subtle manner perplexing questions about war and global conflicts, the loss of innocence, and racial stereotyping. As such, the exhibition explores the vernacular language of comics as a springboard for abstraction, not to withdraw from reality, but to engage with it more critically. The poignancy of abstracting an image by blurring, erasing, or unpainting a motif actually raises the stakes attached to recognition, making us look harder at the ways in which latent representation takes on renewed social and political relevance. Espousing superhero comic characters as legitimate catalysts for change, Polly Apfelbaum's Blossom, which the artist calls a fallen painting in reference to its irreverent position on the ground, is inspired by the popular cartoon series The Powerpuff Girls, featuring three toy-like action figures, Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup, whose mission is to fight crime and save the world from evil before bedtime. The floor paintings are abstract portraits of the comic trio. Discussing the rise to girl power, the artist notes, "I like the idea of a strong, somewhat promiscuous female role model, the slightly out-of-control quality of these cartoon characters." This work, like the cartoons on which it is based, is highly controlled and painstakingly put together, yet still articulates the delirious thrill of topsy-turvydom. Infused with a salacious, locker sense of humor, Sue Williams' paintings are permeated by sexual motifs that touch on issues of abjection and violence, rendered in strokes of vivid color with a fluid, cartoonish energy. Because of her modern tone, Williams has been hailed as the James Gillray of sexual politics, feminism's Honoré Daumier, or the equal in viciousness and sophistication to William Hogarth, placing her in the grand tradition of the most infamous satirists in art history. In Mom's Foot, Blue and Orange, the artist uses sexual motifs of big toes, rubbery fingers, and pudenda-like feet that summon at once Jacques-André Boisfar's close-up photographs of toes with roughly cut nails and the famous hinged foot of Don Martin's cartoons in Mad Magazine. Undoing figuration, Undoing Figuration takes on psychological implications in the wall paintings of Venezuelan artist Arturo Herrera. Herrera slices, fragments, and reconfigures images from the pages of cartoons and coloring books to revisit age-old themes of innocence and experience. His metamorphosed characters, mostly purloined from Disney, and in this case you are looking at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, surface from beneath an insurrection of lines, scrolls, and loops. Herrera creates images within images that take their life forms as much from Disney as from Sigmund Freud. A case study in image defacing, the ballooning gestures of his disjointed figures invoke unsettling collisions between juvenile fantasies and grown-up displaced desires. Plumbing the disquieting world of childhood, Juan Muñoz's installation, Waiting for Jerry, exudes at once a sense of menace and absurd humor. Born in Madrid in 1953, Muñoz grew up during the last two decades of Franco's dictatorship, an era when freedom of speech was repressed in Spain, which explains why, until his premature death in 2001 at the age of 48, Muñoz experimented with sound-based installations as a means of interlocution. In Waiting for Jerry, a dark, vacant room is lit by only a trace of light shining from a mouse hole cut into the baseboard of a wall. A soundtrack of cartoon-like noises accompanies this shadowy space. The gags of the cat, Tom, and mouse Jerry unfold in a perpetual game of chase. And at this point, can we have a clip of the sound? Muñoz created this sound installation without characters so that it is an entirely abstract space, yet he imbued it with the mischievousness of its animated inspiration. Waiting for Jerry includes references to Samuel Beckett's theater as a drama of discomfiting situations involving missing players and a comically absurd engagement with the audience. Performance also finds articulation in Ellen Gallagher's elegant, labor-intensive paintings. In two versions of O Susanna, a work that refers to Stephen Foster's American folk song of the same title, which originated from a slave lament about families being torn apart, minuscule marks of racist caricature, blubber lips, and popping eyeballs percolate across the sheets of lined paper that cover the canvases. By inserting minstrel snippets, Gallagher draws on the recitals of black pioneers of theater, such as Bert Williams, noting that the disembodied eyes and lips in her work refer to bodies you cannot see, floating hostage in the electric black of the minstrel stage. Encouraging viewers to play with his whimsical portable sculptures called adaptives, the Austrian artist Franz West states it doesn't matter what the art looks like, but how it's used. In this interactive installation, four adaptives are displayed outside of a cabin with a how-to video. Viewers can take them inside the structure and gesture with them in front of a mirror. According to West, the genesis of the adaptives is rooted in a lexicon of gesticologies, the theatrical posturing and aberrant grimaces his half-brother, the poet Otto Kobalek, made when he talked. But the emphasis on gesture is embedded in a broader Austrian artistic heritage, including the arrestingly contorted physiognomy seen in Oskar Kokocka's and Egon Schiele's portraiture that incorporates performance and puppetry. Defined by scruffy slapstick, the adaptives can turn even the most adroit interactors, as you've seen before, into Buster Keaton performers. When Michel Mayerus died at the age of 35 in a 2002 plane crash in his native Luxembourg, he left an impressive 10-year body of work comprised of images that he had spliced from art, comic strips, and films. Part of a growing generation of artists living and working in Berlin after the wall collapsed, Mayerus has studied in the early 1990s with the conceptual artist Joseph Kossuth in Stuttgart. Taking cues from strategies of pop and conceptual art, he treated painting as a zone of contamination, completely annihilating the divide between high and low. In Explosion, a cluster of red eggs evokes Martin Kippenberger's mythology of the world as giant egg and the artist as Eggman, while the phrase "catch 'em all" is called from the Japanese cartoon Pokemon, whose characters are born out of eggs. And in Michel Mayerus, flashing across the surface of 25 stacked monitors is the animated image of Mayerus' constantly morphing signature. Flirting with the Warholian trope of celebrity, this abstract self-portrait is sampled from animated films and Japanese manga culture. The Algerian-born Philippe Parenos' practice revolves around what he refers to be an aesthetic of alliances, meaning dialogues and group debates with other artists, writers, and architects. Since the early 1990s, most of his projects have been developed in concert with his friends, the artists Pierre Huyghe, Dominique Gonzalez-Forster, Rirkrit Hiravania, Liam Gillick, Carsten Holler, and Douglas Gordon. A good image is always a social moment, says Pareno, whose playful installation of 100 unmarked white helium-filled balloons in the shape of comic book bubbles nods to Andy Warhol's Silver Clouds, produced in 1966 at his New York studio, also known as The Factory. Parenthetically, the allusion to The Factory is pointed, since Pareno originally conceived speech bubbles for the French Union Association to serve as a tool for organized protest in a French workers' strike, allowing the individuals to write in their own shibboleths, while, as the artist put it, marking their own demand while still participating in the same image. While Pareno transforms images into politicized cartoon characters, Brazilian artist Rivaneno Inchwander tackles the politics of Walt Disney by dismantling a historic edition of the popular comic book Je Carioca, which the animator created in 1941 when he visited South America during World War II. Inchwander recalls that at times Je Carioca, a soccer-playing green parrot, whose name translates as Joe from Rio, acted in stories with nationalistic overtones. She says his character was based on a stereotypical cliché of the Brazilian, street smart, lazy, a lover of soccer and samba, a flirt and a swindler. The cliché of the cliché, he ended up helping to crystallize the national image of the malandro, or rascal. Offering a clean slate, the artist overpainted the figures in monochrome colors and whited out the text, turning each page into an abstraction. Akin to Neuschwander's subversive reworkings of comic books, Gary Simmons' chalk drawings on blackboards depict partially erased characters from animations of the 1930s and 40s that stereotype African Americans. Racial motifs lurking inside seemingly innocent race-neutral images are at the root of his work. Notice the emphasis placed on physiognomy in Crazy Conductor, his wide open eyes and thick-lipped smile, because Simmons explains, "There is that old joke, open your eyes or smile so I can see you in the dark, or don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes." Simmons' erasures create traces of a ghostly presence confronting viewers with the specters of a troubled past. Expending as much energy erasing an image as he does constructing it, the artist presents an extreme version of drawing as a process of subtraction. After meticulously drafting his picture, he attacks it with his hands clad in thin golf gloves, which allows him to feel the pressure needed to wipe out a drawing without completely destroying it. This mural scale piece, titled Boom, portrays a cloudburst-like blast. In comics, Simon says, the blast is a comedic trope for violence. It is fascinating the way violence entertains people. Cartoons are the first and earliest forms of getting pleasure from a violent act. This is why Boom is such an important piece. Julie Mehretu's paintings, like the walls of a city covered with graffiti, convey the chaos of large metropolises marked by migration, warfare, and political riots. Generating a new form of history painting, Mehretu extrapolates bits of architecture and airport plans from her own itinerant experiences to create synthetic words that shatter into other pictures and stories. Born in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, later growing up in the States and Senegal, she conceives laboriously layered paintings that mine a span of art history as broad as her own nomadic trajectory. Umberto Boccioni's The City Rises finds resonance in her work, as does a found comic book image, Bloom Bavoom, which illustrates a massive explosion. The numerous dots and hatch marks seen across the canvas are what the artist calls the characters or agent of change. Acting like superhero characters in comic books, they fight against malevolent forces, escaping cartoon explosions, overthrowing obsolete systems, and performing miraculous deeds. Inga Ezenhai also sees her canvases as arenas for action. Her scenes of goofy calamity and cyborg mutations have variously been described as surreal riffs on Japanimation, Disney meets manga, and manga meets Roberto Mata. She plays with spatial perspective and foreshortening in ways that are dear to cartoonist techniques. Like Plastic Man and Mr. Fantastic, her endlessly malleable characters have the ability to mold their bodies into any conceivable shape. In Cheerleaders and Sky, an exuberant cerulean sky recreates the rococo buoyancy of Giovanni Battista Tiepolo's 18th century ceiling frescoes. Yet, in this painting, Tiepolo's pantheon of heavenly creatures is substituted by a group of mechanomorphic cheerleaders, symbols of American optimism. Headless, faceless, and devoid of human consciousness, they vibrate with a futuristic anime quality that hints to comic release. Takashi Murakami's work is also infused with humor, yet his humor tends to be dark, touching on the complicated circumstances of contemporary Japanese identity in the aftermath of World War II. Murakami's super flat art entwines two facets, one angling towards cuteness and infantilism, the other towards sexuality and violence. While the graceful arabesque in his paintings Cream and Milk from the Splash series recall traditional Japanese folding screens, the arcs of liquid stretching across the gender pink and blue backgrounds allude to the fertile fluids discharged by hypersexualized adolescents of his own cartoon characters, Hiropon and My Lonesome Cowboy. Inspired by Hokusai's The Great Wave at Kanagawa and the erotic manga tradition developed from the uninhibited woodblock prints of the Edo period, Murakami's abstractions find expression in the culture of comics, epitomizing Japan's adolescence fantasies. Examining the power of images, the way they circulate in everyday life, the stories they purport to tell, and by extension, the mythologies that lurk beneath their surfaces, comic abstraction, image breaking, image making highlights the intensely personal bonds that contemporary artists sustain with the political situation of the world. I thank you, and now the artists will discuss their work, beginning with Polly, following with Inga, and concluding with Gary. Polly.
Hi. I'm going to talk about three bodies of work. There's only 12 or so slides, so don't worry. Each one relates to this theme, comic abstraction. Work I'm going to show covers almost 20 years. Comic narrative and abstraction, form and structure, have been constant themes for me. So this is a context I'm very happy to be in, and I want to thank Roxana for her curatorial vision. I'm going to start off by reading two quotations from artists I admire. The first is from Jay DeFeo, and it's a quotation that I often refer to. She says, "Only by chancing the ridiculous can I hope for the sublime." Thinking about that in context of this show, I would associate the ridiculous with the comic and the sublime with abstraction. For me, you need both, and it's this tension that I admire in her work and in the work of a lot of the other artists in this show. The second quotation is from another important 20th century abstract artist, the animator Chuck Jones. What's interesting about what Chuck Jones has to say about his work is how much he emphasizes rules and structure. Good comedy, he tells us, is not just a free-for-all. The rules and disciplines, he writes, are properly difficult to identify, but there are and must be rules. Without them, comedy slops over the edges. Identity is lost. He also goes on to quote another great abstract artist, Groucho Marx. Comedy is not so much what you do as what you don't do. So I quickly want to read a few of Chuck Jones's rules for the roadrunner, which I've found kind of helpful in understanding his comic abstraction. Rule number two, no outside force can harm the coyote, only his own ineptitude or failure of the Acme products. Rule number four, no dialogue ever except beep beep. Beep beep is the Esperanto of comedy. Rule number five, the roadrunner must stay on the road, otherwise, logically, he would not be called a roadrunner. Rule number eight, whenever possible, make gravity the coyote's greatest enemy. And the last, rule number nine, the coyote is always more humiliated than harmed by his failures, a bit like being an artist. So on that note, I'm going to show some work. I started showing in New York in 1986, so... And in the early 80s, this is work that I don't think a lot of people know, but the piece on the left, and it was on a pedestal, and it's called the Mickey Mocker. And Mocker in Yiddish is a big deal. And I think Mickey, everybody must agree, is a big deal. So for me, he's also just a bunch of circles, too. And I was very interested in the abstraction of the animation. And so I just started drawing. And the drawing's like kind of an architectural plan, finding the form. And the form that I found was Mickey, the big deal. I was very interested in this just very simple, iconic form. All the exploration was in the drawing. The form was just a simple pattern made form. I did not make the form. I wasn't interested in my hand. Oops, there we go. Another from this era, and it's called Cut Flower, just a kind of little dancing flower form, still up on a pedestal. And these are a series of comic heads, almost kind of iconic masks. The piece on the left is after the Yellow Boy. Then I had the Barker. I had kind of generic kind of figures. I had a man, a woman. I had just all these kind of playful kind of cartoon character masks. I thought that the mask, the head, that's where all the kind of information, the kind of important iconic information was. So this very simple flat sign, recognizable but highly abstracted. Can you focus on the left? I don't have the focus. Sorry. I think on the left. Is it still out of focus? Is that okay? From this series, too, when I was kind of finding form in the geometry, I decided to appropriate. This was kind of the time of appropriation, the 80s. And this is, what I was stealing was from Warhol. And these are Warhol's graphic design signs. And they're called dingbats. And dingbats are graphic design signs. And this piece was called the Daisy Chain. The last piece in this series was called A Pocket Full of Posy. And I was interested in a different kind of form. The woodwork really took me to the floor, and I wanted something very intimate. This was a piece, if anybody knows, The Pocket Full of Posy is really about the blight. I think that's what it... but this piece was just these simple little flowers. I also call it my kind of... charm bracelet for Madonna. But I was interested in just a very intimate kind of form that kind of commemorated, memorialized, but wasn't interested in this big kind of, I was not interested in kind of the macho form. I wanted to just put a little charm bracelet outside and in the environment. Okay, so now we're going to go to the 90s. I had a sort of meltdown. I was interested in a lot of different things, and everything seemed to fall into this show, and the show was called The Blot on My Bonnet. And in this, I think there are a lot of historic precedents. I was thinking about Linda Benglis. I was thinking about a lot of kind of formal issues that I didn't see out in the work, and I was also thinking about bringing as many kind of different conceptual ideas and also formal ideas into the mix, with a kind of darker side of the blot, the stain. The piece on the right is called The Dwarves Without Snow White. And the color bringing, at this time, if people were around in the 90s, they noticed there wasn't a lot of color, there wasn't a lot of visual pleasure, there wasn't a lot of ambiguity in form. And I was really curious to bring all this into the mix, using cheap, kind of artificial, malleable form. I wanted form that was more of a domestic place, of a kind of more familiar, more of the everyday. And this was, for me, discovering the world of the floor, too. And the kind of dwarves I thought were much more interesting and emotional, and color and form were much more interesting than this kind of purity and the idea of Snow White. I was really not into Snow White. But if you count how many boxes there are, you'll see that there's one for Snow White, and that was if she got her act together. So in this, you have this kind of rigid form, and then I was getting away from the pedestal and throwing the material onto the floor. And I love the kind of fluidity and the kind of collapse of the floor, that the fabric would react to the floor. Peggy Lee and the Dalmatians and Sleeping Beauty. Peggy Lee had been screwed by Disney, and so I wanted to give her a piece. She had written the lyrics for Lady and the Tramp, and I like this idea of the giving Peggy Lee her due. The Sleeping Beauty was always in a coma, so I wanted to kind of give honor Sleeping Beauty, kind of change the... But, you know, I think I was looking at a lot of art historical precedents when I came to New York. The work that I was excited about was process-oriented. It dealt with kind of much more formal issues, and I was trying to get that and the content back into the work, into the kind of the dark side of the narrative. These were very, for me, very experimental works. I kind of... didn't exactly, kind of was putting as much into it as I think that when I look at this work now, I'm like, oh my God, there just was so many different ideas going on. But Puddle in Pink, that color could be shocking, that it could be sexy, that form could be fluid and could be of this world, and also the Pink Dalmatians. So the last series I'm going to show started out with this kind of pop cliche idea, the wallflower, the woman who wasn't asked to dance. You know, I think I'm a desperate optimist, and in this I was using the wall as a kind of formal structure, turning a negative to a positive. And each one of these pieces were based on a cliche and a different idea of color. This one's wallflower mixed emotion. They were done very intuitively. They kind of referenced beauty and the rose window. They're made out of little paper flowers. Every time they change, I do it by hand. It's getting much more intuition into the work. They're very beautiful. And I really love this idea that, yes, it's a target, it's pointed, but it also is this very beautiful rose window. And it was really these pieces that were done about 10 years before that led me to the Wallflowers, and I mean to the Powerpuff Girls. And I had just heard about the Powerpuff Girls, and I thought it was a wonderful way of kind of orienting a show, of structuring a show. But it was also going back to the kind of cliche and how stereotyped women have been. And so I was so happy that there was a role model for little girls. It took a long time, and I heard an interview with the creator that the cartoon networks weren't worried about turning off 50% of the population, but they finally, you know, 12 years later or something, they finally decided it was okay that to have the Powerpuff Girls. So each one was based on a hair color. It's a system of dye. They are a spiral of color. And each one, there are 101 colors. And for me, putting the potential and kind of all the possibility of color in there. They really float. They're very, you know, I didn't even know sort of what they were going to look like. And just the fact each one, the weight of the color has a different kind of personality too. I really thought, you know, all these years working with this kind of cheesy, slinky fabric, it was so exciting for me to find the Powerpuff Girls that, you know, you could be beautiful and cute and kick-ass too. And I wanted them to each have a different kind of position in the gallery space. So the Powerpuff Girls really were a structure and an idea behind the form. And the blonde, here, let's keep going, that's Buttercup, Bubbles, and the one that's upstairs. And you can see there on the detail that I dyed red around the color to give it sort of its bounce. And then I also want you to have a sense of the kind of organic form so that I cut around the form. So the mechanism and the structuring of the piece were really important. But on the underside, there's still the Powerpuffs. So 7 years, this piece was done, it's funny, that was 7 years ago, it was done in 2000, feels like a long time, but a lot of the same ideas are still in some of the recent work too, and I'm going to quick show you. The last show I did in New York, which is a cartoon garden, where I drained all the color, and all of these pieces, the kind of animated line was important, a graffiti line, and also they come out of this whole idea of flower power. Instead of kind of being empowered by the Powerpuff Girls, I decided to try and go back and become empowered by an abstract flower form. All of these came out of a whole series of love. Today I love everybody. What does love have to do with it? Love crazy, crazy love. And this one, Love, Love Me Do, which was done in London. I think a lot of times the art world and in the world is, especially right now, missing in the love factor. And popular culture has always dealt with love. So I decided to embrace the kind of pop artificial colors and the kind of flower power in this work. This is the last piece, and like the little flowers that I had done, the metal flowers, the pocket full of posy, this is a piece that was done in Spain, in Valencia. And for me, it was done right in the beginning of the first war, and I was coming to this country to do a project and was very influenced by kind of hand-painted protest and also about what was I going to bring. And it was very curious to me. I saw this wonderful graffiti, and I decided what I wanted to do is sort of bring the flower power back to my work and to the installation. And the best thing was that it got graffitied. And so you can see the little skulls. So on that note, I just wanted to say I think I'm still working between the ridiculous and the sublime. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Inka Essenhai, and I'm so this is Blobs 1995, and this is perhaps the first. I'm going back to when cartoons kind of started coming out. I'm 1995. I've just graduated from School of Visual Arts, and I'm living in New York City. I'm painting in an abstract expressionist way, and I'm just in my studio moving paint around, kind of looking for form, looking for meaning in an abstract way. And all that kind of comes out. I'm having trouble finishing. I'm trying to look for something. And the things that always came out were cartoons. And I think, cartoons have always been a part of my life. I grew up on them. If anybody wants to test me on my cartoon knowledge during the panel, go ahead. But I think I've always been a little bit, I put that in the bag of illustration, and I wanted to make something more meaningful. And so whenever something like this would come along, I would, let it come along, let it be kind of a cartoony shape, but then most of the time I would kind of like bury it in more paint or something. Until one day, I had a job doing fabric design, and I was actually much more interested in the fabric that I was making than I was in anything that was going on in my studio, and I came up with a whole series of paintings called Wallpaper for Girls and Wallpaper for Boys, and and I suppose this is the first time that I had meaning. A lot of time I was actually worried about being kind of cartoony. I was worried about being light. I wanted, for there to be real meaning and for it to come from something way deep inside me, and that would, I didn't know what it would look like, but I didn't anticipate it to look like this. But once I started making light, cartoony work, it, fit me, and I was completely happy. And it's not that I put a lot of stock on this. I didn't search for great meaning. It did have a gender theme, but and here we have Wallpaper for Girls. But it's not something that I worried about too much. Like, what did it mean? How important was it? It was fun to make the forms, and that's all that was really important. And if anybody has any questions, you can yell them out. Here's the detail. And a lot of these works were really, those works were done, I was an oil painter for most of my life. The works that I just showed you were done oil on enamel. And that was sort of like a big breakthrough for me. One part of my painting is that I always consider myself to be much more of a drawer than a painter. And it's always much more easy for me to come up with, form from line than it is, from moving paint around. But and I don't know where I finally just got the idea of just removing all the paint, getting rid of all the claustrophobia and just putting a blank ground of pure color of enamel, and that way I could have wiped it off. It was if I didn't like it, I could just wipe it off and it didn't have to leave a trace. And that kind of developed into this next series of work where if you ever see one, well, it's the works that are in the show right now, and they're very shiny. And it kind of came about by an accident. I had some enamel. It had curled. I had to sand it down. And then all of a sudden I could get a patent leather surface. And so now that kind of started to free me up. I could start to make form. I could I could just erase it, not just by taking it away, because with an oil painting you always see it. There's always a ghost of something there. But with this enamel painting, with this new technique of sanding it down, I could really get a race, and it opened up the work to a whole new meaning of artificiality and plastic, and all of a sudden this world became artificial and plastic. And that was really the main content of the work. And even though I might have themes like this is, you know, deluge, it's 1998, it's an El Nino year, and it was the first year where we had really weird weather. The kind of went along with the kind of artifice of the world that we were living in. But really, a lot of the content just comes from the paint itself. So, in other words, I can put down one big color. I can randomly just go in there and start drawing. Whatever happens. And if I like it, I keep it. And if I don't, the last thing that goes down is the background color. So the last thing that goes down is the gray, once again. Or, you know, it can change as many times as it wants. This is called Cosmos, once again, it didn't really matter. I didn't have to come to this work with an idea of what this was about. It could just be about whatever happened on the canvas, and that's why I considered myself to be essentially an abstract painter. I mean, people would like to try to point out what this was about, but it didn't really matter. As I always tried to say, if I needed a shape, a big red splot on the lower left-hand corner, I would go ahead and put the great big red splot in and figure out what it was later. This is called Car Crash. And this is about 1999. Don't really have anything to add about this. And then I have, this is called Beauty Contest. I mean, usually a lot of the themes that I would work with were these kind of cartoony people that would just kind of come out. You know, you can see that these are three girls who are fighting for the prize of the, you know, like the top prize, the top circle that they're all trying to get to. There's the envelope on that's the blue thing on the right. And they're all fighting it out. And I guess I had a lot of themes about artificial beauty. There was a lot of artificial weather and artificial, you know, going to the gym and pumping yourself up. So there was, but I didn't take it, it's not something that I took that seriously. I mean, I could say that this was all about, you know, contemporary work. It was really important for me for them to look contemporary, to feel very 90s, to feel kind of artificial. But it's not that I don't feel as though that I was so deliberately trying to make a critique of that. On some level, I think I kind of liked the artificiality, the plasticness of it. This is called Reconstruction. And it's sort of like an operating room table. A lot of the paintings you can kind of read, they're kind of like a story all in one, like a comic book story all in one, where it starts off at the left and it traces, you know, a mark from kind of left to right, so that as if there was a movement that you could, a progression, a narrative progression. So at the top, it's like this guy is coming, you know, he's just a puddle of blood. He gets up on the operating table, he goes through the procedure, and then at the end he's paying his bill, which is the kind of long readout, the little light green strip coming down. He's signing his bill. This is called White Rain, and it's a unicorn. I have a lot of themes of sometimes, you know, of mythological themes, but I don't mean for them to be from the old-fashioned notion. It's whatever, you know, you would bring, whatever symbolism you would bring, or associations. And I associate unicorns with little girl stuff. So, White Rain kind of is about like the hairspray, and they're coming down, and they're going to make it into this kind of perfect little hairdo. of, so she's curling her hair on the right, and it's kind of like a little My Pretty Pony kind of theme. And this is one of my more abstract works. This is called Garden Borders, but, you know, this is a painting that, you know, usually I find people in them, you know, and that's the first thing that kind of comes out is people. I never really found the people. I mean, there's kind of two heads on the lower right-hand corner. There's some babies at the top, but, you know, and I came up with sort of like a narrative where the little babies would be coming down, perhaps like a fallopian tube kind of situation. But, you know, this was all free association on the canvas. And then came a time where, for reasons that, it's kind of hard to go back and explain why, but I guess I always knew that I was going to one day go back to painting with oils. One of the reasons why I wanted to go back to oils was that I really couldn't paint heads. And whenever I would, it would always look too specific, you know, like everything else kind of had its place. And then once I painted a face or a head, it always seemed kind of much more out of place. You know, I couldn't make it abstract enough. Or if I did, then it wasn't really a face anyway. I couldn't find a way to make it kind of an everyman without kind of coming up with a cartoon figure, you know, like that you would have to identify and point to and wonder who is this guy and what does he want? How am I supposed to relate to him? And it's faces and people are probably the main reason why I like to make paintings. I like to make pictures of people. So even though this is in oil, it looks very much like the enamel paintings, but I just sort of wanted to clear the room to go back, you know, to clear the way so that eventually that I would have a more space to go and do more other things. And here we're getting a little bit more narrative, and this is called Arrows of Fear. Kind of like a scene of the Minotaur who's just turned the corner, and these are all the frightened people who've just seen him. And then this is called Fantasy, and this is about 2002. And this painting, even though it has a lot of the same themes that I was working on, you know, like artificial beauty, unicorns, and all that, and little girl stuff, but here, because of the size of the person, this is the first time, I didn't think about this when I first started out making this painting, and still, when I make a painting, I still do not know what I'm going to make. I still start off with just like maybe a general idea or a little line on a canvas, and I say to myself, oh, that looks like this, and then it kind of goes down this path, and unicorns and people come out. But when I got to her face, I realized that this was it. I had to kind of figure out who was this person. And I would say that this is the work where it's no longer abstract. Once I paint a face and I have to decide, do I like this person? Who is she? Then it's not about abstraction anymore. You know, before it was just like every man or nobody or could be anybody. You know, they're conscious. And now I'm making somebody who's got a conscience. And it took me a long time to finish it because I couldn't decide whether I liked her. Finally, I decided that maybe I don't like her, but she likes herself. And that's good. You know, because now all of a sudden I felt actually responsible for a living human being that I'm going to put there out there, and they have to live with themselves with the rest of their lives like that. And if I, you know, hate them, why would I do that? Why would I put out, mangle a person and put them out there in the world to live? And that became much more of a stronger sense part of what I want to do is I do want to make living people out there in the world. You know, I think of these people as you know, I want to make them more conscious and more sentient. This is called Power Party. Now, still, this is, like, pretty cartoony. I mean, you know, I don't think I'll ever get away from cartoons. I love them, and I don't even think of them as being cartoony. I don't think of them as any more than I think of... I mean, I look at Picasso, and I think he looks cartoony. I look at Francis Bacon, and I think he looks like Heavy Metal magazine. The difference with those painters is that they... Or, you know, anybody, really, modernist, but is that... I think that they were trying to take away consciousness. You know, I look at a Picasso, and I was trying to figure out, why does he not have to worry about who these women are that he's painting? And because he's kind of taking out the eyeballs, you know, the two eyes that are looking back at you. And here, you know, I think that for me that's maybe I'm beating this like a dead horse or something, but that makes a real difference. And so here you have Power Party, and everybody's looking at you as you walk into the room, and, you know, there's something wrong with you, I guess. This is Brush with Death. And, you know, these are still... I'm still making paintings where when I begin a painting, I don't know what it is. I just start off, and whatever comes out, comes out. These are now on canvas, and the reason why I moved... The ones before were on panel. Actually, Fantasy was on canvas. The ones before were on panel because I still had the option of kind of, like, taking stuff out. But I wanted to... you know, I started to think that that working like that, where I could take stuff away, was sort of like a way of hiding. And I wanted to not hide anymore and just make the big, bad, ugly, you know... image and have done with it, and not hide, and not edit, and not spend all this time kind of doubting myself, but just say it and move on. But nevertheless, I still don't know what I'm going to make when I start. This is called Bullies. This is 2005, and you know, this is, you know, like yeah, I don't know. I guess this is a little bit more content. This is a little bit up and around the war and feeling kind of hysterical about it. I think of the guy in the middle as a little bit of a Homer Simpson type. And, you know, here it's okay for me to make people that are a little bit, like, mangled and ugly because they're involved with themselves. So I don't have to, they're just doing their thing. I can relate to these people. I can relate to the guy on the right. this is called Shopping. And, you know, when I come up with a cliche, I still kind of go with the comic book version of a cliche. Those steaks are straight out of Warner Brothers, like your my idea of what meat looks like. Even though I've never been to a grocery store and saw meat that looked like that, that's the way it looks on, you know, with the little round hole. That's the way it looks like in cartoons that I grew up with. This is called In Bed. And I should have called it The Little Worries, because, you know, it's sort of like the little worries that are coming in the middle of the night to... rip your to mess with your stomach. It's not nearly, I don't think of it as nearly as violently as other people do. It's not a metaphorical disembowelment, but I mean, it's a it is a metaphorical disembowelment, not a real one. But and I just wanted to end with one of my most recent paintings. This is called Picnic. I guess I too want to make paintings about love and see that as kind of a real deficit out there in the world. in the art world. You know, there aren't a lot of paintings about that. And it took a long time to find it in my heart to make a genuinely, unabashedly happy painting. It was it can be kind of hard. Okay. That's it. Okay.
Hi, I'm Gary. That was pretty amazing. You know, when Roxana emailed me about, well, A, the show, I want to thank Roxana for putting together the show. I think it's a fantastic show, and it's overwhelming to be in a show with some of these people that I've been looking at and admired for such a long time, and to sit here on the panel, you don't, usually you have these boring sort of talks where you go someplace and it's just you by yourself, you know, endless empty faces out there. But it's kind of great to actually hear Inca and Polly talk about their work and what it means to them personally. So it's kind of great. I guess I'll start by giving a little background on how I even got to some of the cartoons. I was working on a film, actually. I wanted to put together a film on how children were sort of taught violence and racism and how to, basically how to hate. And I thought, well, what's the best way to do that? So I started to research a lot of old cartoons and very early part of the, I guess, 2030s, Tex Avery, people like that, that were putting together things like Betty Boop, Little Old Bosco, all those early Disney cartoons. And I started to really look at them and try to break them down because it occurred to me that violence was softened by this sort of, as Polly said, beat, beat. And I really started to look at some of the films of Disney. And the film that we looked at most closely was Dumbo. And I thought, Dumbo's a really interesting cartoon to deal with because he's this little, everybody probably knows that he's this elephant with these big ears and, he doesn't know how to deal with them. And there's these crow figures in the film that teach him that he can actually fly. And they were very racialized. They were sort of these very step and fetch it sort of crows. I started to talk with different friends about their memories of Dumbo as a film. And I started to see that it was starting to break down into racial lines, that sort of artists of color or folks of color would sort of remember these crows and other folks didn't. And I thought, wow, this is a very interesting concept. Like, do we actually internalize identity through these images when we're that small? So I sort of put it in the back of my mind, and we were trying to think about how we're going to cut up this film. Film never happened. But speed forward, I sort of had a show that was happening in Los Angeles with a gallery that wasn't – they wanted me to do the show, but they didn't want to ship the work. And I thought that was very interesting. This will probably be the first and last show that we'll do. So I had this piece that was very important to me that basically it was I made a lectern like this, and I had this chalkboard that was sitting behind it, and on the lectern was a live parrot. The parrot was mic'd, and she would scream out into the gallery all day long, like, fuck you, and I love you, and all this stuff. It drove the gallery staff crazy. But they didn't want to ship the piece because they thought the chalkboard was too heavy. So I said, okay, well, I guess I have to do this piece, so I'm going to just paint this directly on the wall. And the installation was really, it affected me in a very in a profound way, the way that I didn't consider prior to doing the piece. The bird would move and gesture on the pedestal, and the way that her wings would flap created this sort of trail of almost like erasure. I kind of went back home, put that one in the vault, and put it together with some of the images from the Dumbo. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to kind of... The interesting thing about a chalkboard is that if you mark it and then you try to erase it, there is this ghosting and a trace that remains. And I thought that the chalkboard being this place where we learn, place where we teach, place where we get all this information as children was the perfect place to start doing some of these drawings. So I started to do I started this erasure series with the Dumbo crows and would erase them. And it would sort of abstract the image, and it would leave it in the viewer's hands to sort of fill in the gaps. And this, for me, sort of mirrored the way that we reconstruct our own memories of things. And this specifically was related to racial identity. I thought that this is like a sort of a violent act, a willful act, a constant trying to erase a stereotype that's out there, but bits and pieces and fragments of it remain. So this is the first erasure drawing in the Dumbo series. And this is one of the crows. This is the first wall drawing that I ever did in Los Angeles. So what happened was is when I went from the paper to the wall, actually, I'll tell you another quick story outside. I was working once with Robert Irwin on an outdoor project, and we were working for days at a time digging this huge piece up in Wave Hill. And day after day, folks would drop off of the project because it was just backbreaking work, and we were just digging these holes. And Robert sort of looked at me and said, "You know, why do you keep coming back here? Everybody leaves. Nobody wants to stay, and I keep hiring new guys, and you keep showing up." I said, "Man, I'll run through a wall if you ask me. You're Robert Irwin, you know. I'm here for the long haul." So we started to eat lunch together and stuff, and I said, "Well, what are we doing, actually?" And he said, "Well, you know, I was given this outdoor project, and you know, looking at this landscape, you can't really build up and just sort of block this landscape. You can't compete with this landscape. So I thought, why not change the vision of the viewer and go down?" So we dug this 3-foot sort of ditch that was lined with Corten steel, and I thought it was just one of the most amazing pieces. And he saw this as a painting or a drawing. And that led me kind of to the thinking that set the groundwork in a way for going to the wall and thinking of the wall and the institution as a place that you can actually comment on at the same time drawing on. So I really liked the idea that I had these issues with this gallery, and here I am doing these erasure drawings that are, you know, sort of implying or including the gallery and the gallery system into the dialogue of the work. So that's where the real sort of power of some of the wall drawing, erasure drawings really, really started. At a certain point, as any artist, you start to create a kind of vocabulary with your work, and you start to get, you know, confident. And I started to get very ambitious, and I started doing these enormously big drawings. But the imagery was starting to become fragmented from its location, and I started to put bits and pieces and imagery and iconography together to form other images and forms. And so I would take this. In this case, this is a wall drawing called "Here's Honey." Excuse me, "Here's Honey," and she is a sort of Mickey Mouse-esque character from the 40s. That it was her and Bosco, and they were basically like Mickey and Minnie, except they were these little stereotypical black figures. So I started to really play with them as these characters at the time of all I was doing all this work with Bosco and Honey. And the noose image kept coming up in cartoons, and it was always seen as something. It was always set. The seriousness of it and the intensity of the violence of it was always softened by some kind of joke, whether it be the Wile E. Coyote or it be some Tex Avery character. There was always this inherent violence that was there, but always softened by a joke that came around it. And I always thought that there was this absence of in some of these Honey characters I guess I saw them as a real sort of violent act, and I never really saw the softened sort of humor around them. They were all like very charged, and considering the period that they came from, they were very direct sort of racial attacks. So I sort of tried to flip that and take the noose and turn it into this sort of da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, sort of presentation curtain for Honey to break through. The drawing was really long. It was probably 50 feet. This is the drawing center. This is about 50 feet long, something like that. It was one of the biggest at the time that I ever done. At this point, I started a series of chalkboards, black and green. And the chalkboard was a really, it was connected to me as this sort of iconic image I did a lot of chalkboards. And prior to doing the images, I was doing a lot of sculpture with chalkboards. I'd cut them up and break them up into different word forms to imply kind of government letters, things like that. So the chalkboard had stayed with me for a really long time. I started to take out and fragment a lot of these characters from a lot of different cartoons and put them together to make different commentaries. So it almost became unimportant where they came from. It's just the fact that these images were out there in the world and I could sort of play with them, almost like a visual DJ. So this is Crazy Conductor. This is an installation at the Lannan Foundation where the curator said, you know, would you like to do a wall drawing show? And I was like, sure. You're going to give me all these really beautiful walls to draw on. And I started to really play with some of the images that I was working on before. A lot of the bodies were there before, and the figures, and fragments from the figures, whether they be eyes or lips or whatever it was. And I thought it would be one of the beautiful things about this space was that as I entered it, I thought of it as almost like this beautiful dance hall where two people might enter and sort of, you know, just dance throughout the room. But there was the absence of those figures. So in the drawing, I really wanted to take away almost all figuration and let the viewer become the bodies that move through the space. This was a drawing that I took. There were these spears that were out of some cartoon from the 30s. And in a lot of cartoons that you see, or even still, I suppose, there's always that trickery that happens where the attacker gets flipped and the arrows, in this case, come back at the people that are firing at them. So I really wanted to play with the movement of not only the space, but also the actual objects that were being drawn. This piece is called The Ballroom. And it basically, I set this up with what I was just talking about with the two people. I really thought that it comes from, I started to take all the figures out of the cartoons and just start dealing with the backgrounds. I was looking at things like the Flintstones, where they would be running down the street, and you'd see them passing the same house, like, five times in a row, the exact same house. I thought that was really interesting because they would just take these, they were just cells, and they would just take the figures and put them over and over and over and over past the same thing. So I really started to take out the images, and I thought the absence of those figures actually implied them even more. So it also opened up the dialogue of the work of not just being central to racial constructs. I wanted to actually enter into the viewer's experience or present a situation where the viewer would call on their own experience within those, like, either architectural spaces or imagery that I was drawing. So it sort of expanded out beyond that. At the same time, there was always that little dig that I would always put in every drawing. So the chandelier at the middle is a chandelier constructed of all of these nooses from all these cartoons. After doing the Lannan, I came back home, and this is the old Metro Pictures. And we wanted to do a show, and that show was a real sort of cornerstone or gateway for me to start to move into other areas of memory connected to the drawings. I thought that all the language, all those racial stereotypes, the erasure, all of that stuff was inherent in the imagery, and I no longer felt like I needed to actually have that specific of an image that tied it to racial identity. I thought I could open it up, and it become about a memory and an experience. And so in this case, I did the Ghoster. And I was really interested in how some of those really old wooden, beautiful, you know, like the Cyclone and all those wooden roller coasters from the past are starting to disappear. And I really like this idea of like childhood memories and how people go back to, there are also these ideas about romanticized spaces. Where people meet, greet, whatever. Which led me to Boom. And Boom for me is probably one of the most important pieces I'd ever done to this point. I really like the idea of the explosion being not only a destruction, but also the birth of something else. That there was this moment of violence that occurs, and then all of a sudden it's like a refresher or something, like something gets cleared away. And I really like the idea of the strokes that I used to create these was almost the exact opposite direction of how the image is implied. So if you look closely at the drawing upstairs, I'm actually pulling into it as the drawing feels to be blowing out. So I really also like the idea that this particular explosion was from in every other cartoon you see where two figures will be fighting and you just see these little arms and things popping out. So it also implied the presence of these two figures in a conflict. And for me, it kind of reflected the way that I do the drawings, because I've always seen them as this performance that I leave behind. It's the performance you never see. So there's constantly a trace element to all of the drawings. So I think I'll leave it there, because that's probably the best place to go.
So we have time for just a few questions. Yes, all the way in the back.
I was wondering if some or all of you could talk about the role of title in your pieces, because I feel like it's an important determining factor to me in a lot of your work, and the pieces that you open, and it seems very related to the bridge theme.
Would you like to start about the titles?
Well, Duchamp said, I think he said, that titles are another color. And for me, a lot of times they're a way of structuring, sometimes the structuring after, sometimes the structuring before. Those also a wonderful way of bringing kind of another color to the work.
I try to title my paintings as if somebody was going to move them, and I, you know, say, can you move the in bed? Can you move the pink? the beauty contest. I try to call it what it is, and kind of, I guess, almost making a play on the abstraction, like, you know, what does that look like? It looks like a girl hanging from a noose. Okay, that's what it is. That's what I call it.
I think I do a little bit of both. I get a lot of my titles, I'm influenced a lot by music. So whether the images help me get from there, it could be the song that I was listening to at that time. There's an influence that seeps in, I think. And that's probably where I get titles from. But yeah, I think that it also gives you access to some of the ideas going into the work. And I try to use a sense of humor often, I guess, to kind of soften it as well.
Yes, please.
Do you ever concern yourself with the fact that perhaps
Do you ever concern yourself with the fact that perhaps people who have never seen cartoons in their lives, you know, which are a big percentage of the population of this planet, would probably have difficulty relating to certain of the works, particularly the ones that are directly derivative from things like Mickey Mouse or, you know, the direct references?
Me? Anybody?
No, absolutely not. I think that there's no you don't have to know anything. It's really, my paintings are for your pleasure. You don't need to know anything about it to look at it.
I don't think you have to know anything about it. I think that the images in some ways speak for themselves. I think that at a certain point they become fragmented. So you know, in some cases, I'll isolate eyes or something from a cartoon. So the origin almost is not as important. In fact, often I'd rather not. I'd rather the where they actually came from not be there.
I think that's, you know, it's just another kind of, it can be another reading. If they don't, it's fine. And a little story, a friend of mine brought in her child to see my show, The Powerpuff Girls, and the little, it was, I think it was a little boy, and he said, "Where are the Powerpuffs?" And she said, "They've been smushed." So, so you know.
Anybody else? Yes.
Did you ever become involved with a graphic novel or participated in Museum of Comic? The Museum of Comic Arts programs and activities?
I haven't. I don't.
No. No, I haven't.
No, it's a different medium. You know, it's. I like to make paintings. It's. It might look like a comic, but it's a painting. It hangs on a wall.
Yes.
Yeah. A couple of things. As far as what the one of the earlier questioners was just saying, it sounds weird. I was, you know, the ubiquity of comic book images, it almost feels to me like that's more of a world language than, say, the history of, quote-unquote, you know, the well-known history of Western art, and that Mickey Mouse is, you know, certainly all of the, you know, developing countries, it's you'll find it everywhere. So that almost to me feels like more of a common currency than, you know, what you might learn in for example, an art school. But also I wanted to ask Gary, I thought that was, for me, an interesting sort of shift from the racial themes to the architecture. Mm-hmm. And not knowing a lot of the later work, the thing that they really seem to have in common is this period quality. Mm-hmm. That, for example, those roller coasters were probably built at the same time that Mickey Mouse was being developed. So I'm just wondering, is there still an aspect of race for you in that work? Or is it more nostalgia or what?
That's a good question. Yes, I would say, including drawings that I do now. I think that, you know, as any of, you know, these artists here would say, that I think you start to develop a language with or a vocabulary anyway, with your work. And I think that when I do an erasure, it still talks to and uses a lot of where the original, you have to consider where those original erasures came from when you're looking at the current work as well. And I think that race and racialized space is not just tied to certain images and icons that we think of as stereotype. I think that spaces are haunted by all different types of things. So I feel that if I'm drawing even a gazebo, you're still speaking to notions of race and class specifically, without using those, what I would call obvious, direct hits. I think that it sort of adds a layer too. So if you're looking at some form of architecture, in some way you have to kind of think about where these erasure drawings come from and what does that mean when I'm doing those now. So for me, they become more interesting and complicated once you start removing some of those things. And it starts to you start to think about how you're either connected to, you know, affected by some of the language that those drawings are trying to get at.
So, just following up on that question, but what did it mean to you to draw on the walls here at the museum?
I was hoping nobody would know. You know, it's a complex question. I mean, I think that, you know, on one instance, you know, MoMA represents a certain kind of icon in the art world as an institution. So you have to think of it as that. So when I'm drawing on there, I'm thinking about that. Then I'm also thinking also about some of the work that's been on those walls. So there's a history to the walls as you're doing it. It's almost like ghosts talking to you. So in that way, it's, you know, for me personally, it's a charge. Or I look downstairs and I see this giant Twombly down there, and all of those, you know, I got to where I am looking at a lot of Twomblys and
those pictures. So, but you can't get away from some of the ideas about the institution and what that has meant to gender, race, sexual identity, all of those come into play once you start to include the institution in the dialogue. So I think it's a pretty rich layered thing for me. You know, I don't know if it's there. But.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, or hear from you, a bit about the embarrassment around optimism and love and prettiness and all those. I think Polly addressed this a little bit towards the end. In fact, I think all three of you did. The work seems to be moving in a certain direction. And just wondered, how do you kind of talk to yourselves in your own heads about that movement?
I think that, you know, the world we live in, our culture is so puritanical, and the dialogue is that, you know, it was something, the kind of visual pleasure, visual excitement, kind of sensuality of form, all of these things were things I really wanted in my work, and that's kind of the history of a lot of the work that I looked at, and color and pleasure, all of those things kind of were empowering to me, and I wanted to use them. And certain people had kind of notions of form. Almost, I always said that I'm not a fair weather formalist. Maybe, you know, and I'm a fuck you formalist. So for me, all of those issues of kind of bringing those issues into the work were so important. And also, I think the idea of kind of high-low and craft, certain things that were kind of embarrassing places to be, but for me they were so interesting and so tantalating, and art is about desire and kind of a visual excitement, and I really wanted it in my work. That. So it has been a bit, as I said, kind of you get over the humiliation. You say, screw you.
I see it as just me getting a little bit older. I mean, just trying to improve my life, and that's all, you know, a change of focus.
I don't know how to answer that question. Maybe it is age. I don't know. I don't know. I think that imagery that deals with beauty, it's debated. You know, when somebody reduces something down to it just being about beauty, I always get very suspect of that because I think that beauty can be challenged and also be kind of scary at the same time, and we're all sort of haunted by that. And you know, and I say beauty, but I also mean love and all of the rest of those things. And I think for me, I'm really interested in the way that we reconstruct our past and romance, and how you'll always leave out some of the bad parts and heighten the good parts, or vice versa. If it was a bad relationship, you always remember all the bad shit. You know, but you never remember like all the good times that you might have had with that person. So I think that you're constantly haunted by those things, and at a certain point you get to the place, like Inka saying, I guess, is that you can start to play with some of those places, you know. So maybe it is a kind of maturity and comfortable in the suit of your own work.
Question for Inkas and Hyde. The anatomy of your figures.
Oh, thank you. The anatomy of your figures is very, very strange and disturbing, and that's part of what makes them so fascinating. Where does that come from? I'm an art historian. I've racked my brains for years trying to figure out where you get it.
I think it just comes from a lot of hours logged on Saturday morning cartoons. It does not come from, if somebody said, oh, it looks like this, I've seen it, I've absorbed it, I do have a really strong visual memory, but I would never want it to look like something else. When people say, oh, you're trying to reference something in particular, I actually think of that as an insult. Like, I want them to be original things, you know, that just have a life of their own. And maybe if it sort of looks haphazard, it's because it was actually haphazard. Like, it didn't, you know, because I have kind of connected all these kind of abstract parts to make a thing. And I've just, you know, watched a lot of TV. I don't know where to get it.
Any other questions?
Hey, thank you. I just had a question. It's a trivia question for you guys. I'm just curious what your favorite cartoon was growing up, since you are the cartoon experts.
It's like asking what's your favorite color. Then you get that brain freeze.
Bullwinkle and Rocky.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like Bugs Bunny. But I really, in book form, I actually grew up on Tintin and Asterix, you know, those European comics. My parents are foreigners, and they had foreign comics. But on TV, I like Bugs Bunny the best.
I guess. I'm trying to think. I'm still frozen. I don't know. I liked McGilla Gorilla a lot.
How about Underdog?
I liked Underdog.
Great. Underdog was great.
Mighty Mouse.
You know? Sherman, what's his name? Sherman, Breezley Bruin, I liked him a lot.
My new favorite, and it was on TV for 5 minutes. Has anybody heard of the Oblongs? They were amazing. Yeah, about a dysfunctional family. And they were kind of, I think, deformed by nuclear waste or something. Like, I thought they were amazing. And I was amazed that they made it on for even 5 minutes.
All right, well, I think that on that note, it will be good to end this. And I want to thank the artist and the audience.
Oh, God.